welcome one and all to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific, our live edition, our Australia post-election special. We are brought to you by IEJ Media and our sponsor, Bauer Group Asia, a strategic advisory firm that specializes in the Indo-Pacific. I'm Ray Powell. I am the co-host. I am also relevant to this discussion. I was once the defense attaché to Australia. My former boss, Jim Caruso, he was the acting ambassador to Australia while I was there. He is now, of course, a senior advisor to Bauer Group Asia, and he is the chairman of the advisory council to the Australia chair for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Jim, how are you?
Well, you know, another election, another day, but it's always fun to watch what's going on in Australia, Ray.
Well, I think we have two excellent guests who can help clarify it for us. And of course, I am going to be as the military guy. I will be asking the basic questions. I'm going to lean on you to ask all the really smart ones.
I don't know if they'll be smart, but they'll be detailed and annoying, which is, you know, what we diplomats do. So speaking of annoying, let me introduce our guests. That's a segue. First guest, Michael Rowland, senior journalist with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, longtime based in Washington, I think during the election period there as well, host of News Breakfast, which I watched religiously for 3 years. And I'm looking forward to some of your puns, Michael. Welcome.
G'day, Jim.
Are you on? And with us also is Mick McNeil. Mick, I worked with at the U.S. Embassy in Canberra for a few years. He is a political tragic who knows everyone in Canberra, Canberra-based. So he was a political advisor for us at the U.S. Embassy, and now he's managing director of Bauer Group Asia in Australia. Mick, good day.
How's it going, mate?
It's all good. So overnight, we had the elections. Everyone seems surprised. Maybe you can explain to us. We'll start with you, Michael. What happened last night, and why should it matter to us in the U.S. or anywhere else?
And g'day, Ray and Mick as well. It was a night for the ages for election watchers, not just in Australia, but around the world. An historic win, a landslide win for the Labor government, solidly re-elected. There are 150 seats in the House of Representatives here in Australia. The magic number to get a majority was 76. Labor went into the election with 78 seats. As the count stands this morning, and the count will continue for some days potentially, Labor has gained anywhere between 7 and possibly up to 15 seats. So a thumping win by the Labor Party. It's the first time in several decades that, in fact, possibly in history in Australia, that a first-time Prime Minister has actually gained his or her majority for his or her government at their first election up for re-election. So a stunning win. Labor did well across Australia in all the states and territories. On the flip side, it was nothing short of a catastrophic loss for the Liberal Party. The party lost seats around the country. It could lose up to 20 seats. And of course, one of the headlines of the night's opposition leader, Liberal leader Peter Dutton, lost his seat of Dixon in Brisbane, in suburban Brisbane. One of the cavalcade of shock results last night, and there is going to be an incredible amount of soul searching within the Liberal Party as to what went wrong. I think I'd summarise the results as the centre holding in Australia. This reinforces my view that Australia is a centrist country. We reject fringes. We reject extreme positions on both sides of the spectrum. And on that front, I should also say it was a very bad night for the Greens, very much a left-leaning party here in Australia. Voters repudiating some of the more extremist views of some of that party's members as well. So we can talk about the impact of Donald Trump and what's been going on in the United States as the conversation goes on, because there was an impact, but an election of absolutely historic proportions last night.
So Mick, maybe you can help set the stage for some of our international audience, those who aren't familiar with Australian politics. So you have Labor, which in Australia is to the left, and Liberal, which may be disorienting to Americans. Liberal is actually on the right. And then the liberals are often referred to as part of, quote, the coalition. And then at the other minor parties. So can you maybe just help set the stage for who are the players on the field? Who are the major parties? Who are the minor parties?
Yeah, so the Labor Party in Australia was formed by the trade union movement in about 1891. So they're the centre-left party. We've had various coalition parties, various conservative parties over the last 100 years or so, 120 years since Federation. The Liberal Party in Australia came into being in 1944. They're the major conservative party in Australia, and they're generally in a coalition with the Nationals. So they started out as the Country Party in the 1920s. Further to the left, we have the Greens in Australia. They've been around since the 70s. It really hit the ground running in the 1990s. They polled at this election around 12%, which is similar to what they polled the last election. As Michael said, they've gone backwards somewhat in the seat count. I just want to go to what Michael said at the start. It was a stunning result last night. This is sort of a record-breaking result for the Labor Party, probably their best result since World War II. I mean, we're looking at a two-party preferred vote here of 55 Labor, 45 Coalition. Now, even though the primary votes are low by historical standards, the preference flows are going very heavily towards Labor. This is stunning, and I think the Liberal Party is going to go into an existential crisis here. They're going to have to work out whether they continue to push back against the left, and continue to engage in these culture wars and anti-woke sort of agendas, or whether push that to the side and focus more on economics. But what do they do on the economic front? Because free trade and deregulation and open markets, that's sort of on the back foot in this era, especially with what's happening geostrategically in supply chain. So the centre right in Australia have got a lot of thinking to do.
Before we get into a discussion of preferences and ranked choice and how that works, let's go back to why we're all so surprised. And I think part of it is because 3 months ago, the expectation was the coalition was going to win. They were ahead in the polls at that moment, right? So what happened in 3 months to change things so dramatically, Michael?
There are a few factors, and Labor figures were being very candid. There's nothing like election nights in Australia. It's similar in the United States. We finally get honest answers from politicians across the spectrum. And we had quite a few senior Labor Party figures on the various election night TV broadcasts saying just that, Jim, that at the end of last year, Labor was deeply, deeply worried about its election prospects. All signs were pointing to a strong win by the Peter Dutton-led coalition. What happened was we get into this election year, we get into the election campaign, and as it became pretty clear as the election campaign, we have a five-week election campaign here in Australia, not the decades that you have for electoral cycles seemingly over in America. We have a short, sharp, five-week campaign. I have been longer, but it's usually 5 weeks. What became clear in the campaign was the opposition, the Liberal National Party, as Mick said, the conservative grouping in Australia, was unprepared. It was rolling out policies seemingly on the run. In a couple of really embarrassing instances, it had to actually do a bat flip on policies during the campaign, which is absolutely political poison for any political party. One big embarrassment for the coalition was they promised to, if elected, end work from home arrangements for Australian public servants. And this sank like a stone. It was unpopular with obviously not just public servants, but other Australians who thought, hang on, if they're going to end work from home arrangements for the public service. What's to stop them doing it for those in the private sector? It polled very badly with female voters. The Liberal Party was very keen to win back women after losing them comprehensively at the last election. So Peter Dutton had to actually ditch that promise mid-campaign. That's just one example of what most people agree was a very badly run campaign. Peter Dutton, it's fair to say, wasn't match ready for this election campaign. He had a tendency to limit his media appearances as opposition leader to a select number of, on a regular basis, select number of conservative media outlets. He didn't really stump up on a regular basis to widespread questioning from the Canberra political core. And I think that showed up in his media strategy during the election campaign as well. And on the other side, we had a laser-like focus from the Labor Party. It got its act together. It rolled out voter-friendly policies. Anthony Albanese, the Prime Minister, ran a disciplined campaign. He had a shocker last time and won regardless, but this time around he stayed on message. And a combination of those two factors, a well-run Labor machine and a poorly run Liberal machine, got the result we saw last night.
And I guess if, just to follow up with that, Michael, Peter Dutton is not new to the political scene. I mean, I remember he was trying to become prime minister when I was there back when Malcolm Turnbull was turned out. How is it that he was not prepared for prime time?
That's a very good question. And that's the question. Yes, go ahead.
I think an element of complacency set into the coalition campaign. I think, and it probably goes back to the rejection of the Indigenous voice, the referendum in October 2023. And, most Labor electorates voted no in that election. I think Dutton thought, and a few others thought, they could just cruise by, on the culture wars. I think he also thought, well, if I just keep saying, are you better off than you were 3 years ago, that, you'd get over the line. But as Michael said, he wasn't match fit. And as Michael also said, the work from home was a debacle. It was just emblematic of the campaign. They rolled that out before the election. They should have known it was a dud. And then he had to backtrack during the campaign, and he apologised, which looked bad and amateurish. I guess that's all he could do. But that work from home, I think that was critical in him losing the votes from families, sorry, in the outer suburbs, because Labor was just able to say, well, this is the thin end of the wedge. If you can do this to public servants, what are you going to do next? Are you going to apply this to the broader economy? And they were able to tie that and the public service cuts with what Trump and, the Doge folks were doing in the US. So at the end of the campaign, you had the Labor Party saying, referring to Dutton as Dogey Dutton. And similarly, the more toxic Trump became, the more they, Labor tried to tie Dutton to Trump. And, at the end, you had Health Minister Butler warning about the Americanization of healthcare. Notwithstanding that Dutton, had matched the government's promises on health. I have to say the Trump-Zelensky White House meeting February 28, that was a massive juncture in the campaign.
But why was Dutton and Liberals tied to that? Why are they so tied to Trump in the Australian electorate's mind?
Well, I think it goes back to soon after Trump being elected, because the Conservatives, the coalition, they kept criticising Albanese and Ambassador Rudd for for stuff they'd said before Labor was elected. They kept rolling out footage of Trump banging out Trump, and they even roll out footage of Albanese when he was in opposition, saying critical things about Trump. So in the public's mind, in some of the public's mind, it was like the coalition were encouraging Labor to ingratiate themselves with Trump. And And when, you know, when the steel tariffs were announced, you know, the coalition ripped into Albanese saying, you know, basically, oh, well, you know, we would have done better. Same with the 10% tariffs. So in the public mind, the coalition were trying to say, well, we're Trump's besties. We can do this better. But post Zelensky, I think even conservatives in Australia, they thought it was a jump the sharks at a moment. A lot of Australians before thought, oh, you know, it's Trump, you know, we can, you know, he'll be somewhat reliable. But after the Zelensky debacle in the White House, Australians started thinking, well, if they can do that to Zelensky, what can he do to us?
So that's really interesting that you bring up the Zelensky meeting and the word tariffs. Is that, well, you know, you did mention it with the steel tariffs. But the Zelensky meeting, at least to listen to what you're saying, seems like it had even a greater impact on the Australian electorate than perhaps even the tariffs.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the polls, that was sort of, I mean, there's a strong correlation. It really created this sense of uncertainty amongst the Australian public. The US is our key ally, and the public was thinking, oh, God, what, you know, could he do this to us? And as you know, there's, you know, around the world, there's the Trump bump, you know. Trump's erraticism has called people to sort of back the incumbent. And, that's what happened here.
Well, this was supposed to be the cost of living election, right? Everyone's complaining about they can't keep up, they can't buy a house, everything's so expensive. And the coalition, theoretically, should have been the ones who say, we can take advantage of that in the run-up to the campaign because we're the economic team, right, historically. And just one other thing, and with China being more active around Australian waters, sailing around the coast with the live fire exercises off of Sydney, coalition should have been able to say, we're also the defense party, and Labor's mucked up defense. And yet, it's as if they ignored these things. Michael, you can explain this?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Historically, in Australia, the coalition has been the go-to party for economic management, election after election cycle. It has polled better on the basic question, who would you trust more to manage the Australian economy? It's been the coalition, not Labor. Cost of living was by far, and each and every poll said this, the most important issue in this election by a country mile. There was also healthcare, housing. We have a housing crisis in Australia as well. But cost of living, and it's tied into both of those factors as well, cost of living was by far the biggest issue. The coalition did have a range of measures to try to ameliorate cost of living issues. It offered a temporary cut in petrol, gasoline taxes, which it hoped to be pretty popular in the outer suburban seats that contain a lot of working families. It also offered a temporary tax rebate as well as various other issues as well, help for first home buyers to get access to the housing market. So it identified the problem and had policies to identify the problem, but it was out-campaigned on that front by the Labor Party, who also had a suite of what turned out to be more popular cost of living measures aimed at improving the lives of Australians as well. And also what didn't help the coalition was some of the messaging from the coalition was lost in its focus regularly during the campaign on those culture war issues that Mick was talking about. Its promise to get public servants back from home into the office, with the implicit assumption that you know, public servants are lazy, they need to work harder. There was a promise to, if elected, pretty much get rid of tens of thousands of public servant jobs that in the end proved very unpopular as well. We had Peter Dutton in a very Trump-like fashion, going after what he described as the hate media in Australia, very much along the lines of fake media, the media being the enemy of the people, channeling Donald Trump. And that sort of stuff got through as well and really distracted the coalition from what should have been its key message on the cost of living. just on defense, which we can talk about in greater depth as well as this conversation goes on, you raise a very important point. Defense as well has been a strong point for the coalition historically. And in one of the several own goals of the campaign, the coalition did not release its defense policy until the dying days of the campaign. On paper, a very good defense policy for all of those in the defense and strategic community who say Australia needs to spend much more on defense. The coalition promised to increase the share of defense spending in GDP to 2.5%. It's roughly around 2% at the moment, at a cost of $21 billion, with an aspiration to increase it to 3% over 10 years, but did not provide any further details on where that money would go. It was, I think, 4 or 5 pages at most on the day. And that promise was lost in the mix because it was released so late. So that's just an example of just how, I guess, poorly run the campaign was on two of those key issues that historically should have been very, very favorable to the coalition.
So I want to, you talked at the top, Michael, about this phenomenon of Australia being essentially a centrist country. But one of the things that plays into that, it would seem to me, is this whole system of preferential voting, or what we in the United States might call ranked choice voting. Can you, one of you, explain how that works, and then, you know, what it does to the outcomes of these elections, particularly, you know, in terms of centrism versus extremism?
Originally, in Australia, we had first past the post voting until the 1920s. And at that point, you know, the major conservative party in Australia was the United Australia Party. But then around that time, the Country Party came on the scene, and that had the effect of just splitting the conservative vote under the first past the post system. And so the conservatives thought, okay, well, we better bring in, you know, this preferential voting because it's you know, benefiting the Labor Party, and so, you know, that's how it started. And so how it works is, if a candidate gets, you know, more than 50% of the first preference votes, they're elected. If they don't, then the candidate with the lowest number of votes on the ballot paper is eliminated, and their second preference votes are distributed.
So when you vote for your first party, second, third, like that?
You have to fill in all the boxes. So I did today in the seat of Canberra, filling all 6 boxes. The cycle just repeats until someone gets over 50%. I also have to say that, you know, in the 1920s, we also introduced compulsory voting. And that was a result of a drop-off in voting since the First World War. Now, what compulsory voting does, it means that the parties don't, well, the major parties don't have to appeal to the fringes and to, you know, the fanatics and the, you know, the political obsessives to vote. It means they have to appeal to the middle in Australia, and that's where, you know, elections are won in Australia, in the centre, as Michael was saying. Unlike other countries, you have to appeal to the centre to win in Australia. And I think sort of Albanese sort of alluded to this, you know, late in the campaign when he said, I'm a reformist, not a revolutionary. So that, you know, the safe change is what Australians like.
I like bringing up compulsory voting, and I'm a bit like a broken record in most, if not all, conversations I have with my many American friends. I wish compulsory voting was something we could export to America. It is one of the most attractive features of our election system, along with an independent, federally run election commission. But compulsory voting hits all those points, as Mick said. It just discourages extremism. It discourages parties taking too much to the left, too much to the right in their get out the vote operations to encourage people to bus people physically to the polls. And we get a much more descriptive result of indication of where the Australian electorate is. So I'd like it to be one of our key exports to the US. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, but it is something we hold very dear here in Australia.
We don't like people telling us we have to.
You go to a polling booth every Saturday. There's a lot of pre-polling, but your election day is a Saturday. Not only you get to vote, you exercise your democratic right, you get a what we call a democracy sausage.
That's the
barbecues. Well, as you gents would know, having lived here for a period, that is one of the best features as well of our election days.
Although you use white bread instead of a hot dog roll, which I don't understand.
Oh, Jim, you should know by now. It needs to be just a slice of white bread. We've had this conversation before.
I know, and you're still wrong. I'm sorry.
So yeah, but like
Jim's still waiting for his bloomin' onion.
But I must say, I echo what Michael says about our electoral system. And look, I think, you know, what transpired was a credit to Australian democracy again. I mean, maybe the policies and the campaign didn't sort of reach the lofty intellectual heights some wanted, but, you know, the election was free and fair. There's no irregularities, you know, foreign interference was sort of, you know, kept to a minimum by the agencies. There's no allegations of, you know, the election being rigged. And I think the high point of the campaign last night was with the speeches by Albanese and Dutton. I thought they were very magnanimous and gracious. Yeah. Unlike other countries.
I agree. And isn't it great, Mick? And I'm sorry, to our American friends, we had this thing called a peaceful transition of power in Australia. And echoing your thought, I reckon...
We usually have one of those.
Usually have, yes. You had one aberration back in 2020, which we won't talk about. The Prime Minister gave a great speech, but I think the speech by Peter Dutton was the most gracious concession speech by an opposition leader in Australia I have ever seen. He was gracious to the Prime Minister. He spoke of how the Prime Minister's late mother would be proud of him. He was gracious to the woman who beat him, the Labor candidate who beat him. There was no bitterness. There was nothing nasty, and I think Peter Dutton will be remembered very fondly for those 5 minutes or so on stage last night in that concession speech.
But you know, this gets into some weird things about elections. Is Peter Dutton in person actually is a funny, clever guy? Why he has to put on the mean cop persona whenever he's in public, I'd never understood, and clearly didn't work. That's another
design. That didn't work. No, I agree. And you've all would have had interactions with Peter Dutton, as I have over the years, and in person. He is very warm.
Yeah.
He's funny. He's very engaging. He's got a lovely, dry sense of humour. And for whatever reason, he has, yeah, as you said, turned on this hard cop message for many years now, and many Liberal Party people have told me over the years that if the Australian voter had seen more of that side of Peter Dutton, more of the Peter Dutton we saw giving that concession speech last night, perhaps people would have been more welcoming towards him and would consider voting for him. But for whatever reason, that was the image he wanted to get across.
Yeah, I think Labor did a lethal job sort of reminding people why they didn't like Dutton in the first place. And I think in the end, Dutton played very poorly with professional women, young people, and multicultural communities. And I think that sort of goes, you know, back to sort of his over the years, you know, polarizing comments on various issues. I mean, he's a former Home Affairs Minister, former Defence Minister, but, you know, he has had a he has had a tendency to, you know, thrive, you know, in engaging in, you know, culture wars and, you know, especially in the national security space as well. And I think we saw, I mean, going back to the Chinese vessel, the live fire exercises, I mean, Dutton was jumped straight onto that when it happened. And in response, you had Penny Wong saying, oh, you know, Dutton's beating the drums of war and being very, you know, irresponsible in his comments. I mean, that said, Richard Marles said that the
Defence Minister.
Yeah, Richard Marles, yeah, Defence Minister and Deputy Prime Minister. He said that, you know, the actions of the Chinese were unprecedented. But I mean, you know, the Chinese in that case, they hadn't broken any international sea laws. I suspect it was probably retaliation for an Australian surveillance craft, you know, a few weeks earlier in the South China Sea. I think at the time US Indo-Pacific Commander was in Australia, but I think that was just a coincidence. But what that live fire exercise did, I think it sort of more broadly, you know, stirred debate about Australia's defence budget and our, you know, maritime preparedness. And I think, you know, the coalition at that point should have, you know, thrown out their defence policy then, rather than, as people on this call have said, you know, wait till, you know, a week out from the election.
So that brings us to the question of, you know, will the Labor Party government pick up the mantle of any of that going forward? In other words, will they sort of respond to the imperative presented by the Chinese task group and say, we also are interested in increasing the defense budget, in addressing our defense requirements?
They're going to have to. And Labor has made the point that it has increased defense spending, which it has. But everybody in, as I said, the defense strategic community agrees that the current 2% level is just woefully inadequate. Given the times we live in, the Prime Minister, Richard Miles, the Defence Minister, have repeatedly said that we live in the most challenging strategic times since the end of World War II. That was driven home, of course, by the Chinese Navy live fire exercises off the New South Wales coast just before the election. We're all seeing what China's up to more broadly in the region. The problem that the government will have is that at the moment, there isn't, for want of a better term, in my view, social license for an increase in defence spending. And what I mean in saying that is the Labor Party, and I think to some extent the Coalition as well, have not properly explained why defence spending needs to go up. Because if defence spending goes up, it's a whack of money. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars. That is going to have to come at the expense of other sections of the budgets, other government spending, potentially politically popular government spending in the health welfare space. And that's going to be politically challenging. I just don't think at this stage, and this may change in this term of government, particularly if it's fast-tracked by further aggressive moves by China, I just don't think the government has made the point for an increase in defence spending at this stage. Mick, you might have a view on that as well.
Just very quickly, I just want to introduce from the chat here, John Godden points out that the live fire exercise actually did have an effect on New Zealand, which doubled its defence budget.
Mm.
Go ahead.
I think if we're going to boost defence spending in Australia, there needs to be some bipartisanship. And I think Linda Reynolds a few years ago was talking about, you know, maybe having more bipartisanship by virtue of a special committee. But look, it was interesting, the campaign. You had Wayne Swan, the former Labor treasurer. He was asked, you know, about defence and defence spending, and he said, "Oh, well, the current trajectory is fine." So that raised a few eyebrows. It's interesting. I mean, 15 years ago, 2% of GDP was the magic number. Now it's apparently 3%. As Michael said, you know, the coalition had promised, you know, 3% within a decade, you know, 2.5% within the next 5 years. But what I think might happen is that Labor brings forward some of their 10-year spend, because a lot of it's back-ended at the moment. So maybe they bring some of that into the Ford estimates. I mean, another issue is, of course, AUKUS. And I think Hastie said this during the camp, Andrew Hastie, the shadow defence minister, said this during the campaign, that, you know, AUKUS is, you know, sucking up a lot of the planned defence spend.
And of course, AUKUS, the Australia-UK-US agreement, yeah. most of the big you know, banana there, of course, is the submarine program, but there's also another track with that focused in on technology.
And we talk about, you know, social license for defense spending. I think, you know, there's going to have to be renewed effort for social license for AUKUS. And you would have seen, I think it was the day before the election was called, we had former Prime Minister Turnbull hosting his security and sovereignty conference in Canberra, which was had basically it was critical of the AUKUS submarine program. It's pretty obvious that that some of the independents, the Teals, are going to make AUKUS an issue during the next term of Parliament. Jackie Lambie, Senator from Tasmania, she's going to push for a Senate inquiry into all aspects of the Australia-US relationship. And I'll also say that the Labor rank and file, very left-leaning, and they're not exactly supporters of AUKUS. And, I mean, they'd be expecting the Albanese, who used to be a hard man of the left. His mentors were hard men of the left. They'd be expecting him, you know, with this huge majority to sort of go back to the old Albo fighting Tories. And there'd be a lot of pressure on Albanese from the rank and file to just, you know, maybe take another look at AUKUS, because it was not a Labor initiative. It was a Scott Morrison initiative.
You guys already gave us $500 million as a down payment. It seems not a good time to renegotiate.
Yeah, well, that's right. But
so very quickly, I do want to grab onto a word that you brought up there, Mick. You used the word Teals, and we haven't really introduced that party in this discussion yet. Who are the Teals? Where did they come from, and why do they matter?
Well, the Teals are. They came on the scene in the 2022 election, so there were six of them elected, all highly credentialed women, backed by a rich guy in Australia called Simon Holmes at Court. He has a fundraising body called Climate 200, a lot of renewable energy interests behind him, and those Teals snatched liberal blue ribbon seats. The 2022 election, in very highly affluent, socially progressive areas. So, you know, basically areas where the people are, you know, rich enough to focus on post-material issues. You know, the Liberals are very keen to win those seats back at this election, and they failed. And it sort of goes to why Dutton had, you know, the strategy he did at this election to sort of just, you know, its path of victory through the outer suburbs and the regions, which, as we know, flopped. But I guess the strategy was right, but in the outer suburbs, but just the tactics didn't resonate. But those Teal seats, it looks like the Teals have a lock on them for a while, because a few of them ran into some controversies during the campaign, but that just seems to have been overlooked by their constituents.
Let's talk about an amazing parallel with another Commonwealth country that had elections recently, which is Canada. Mm. So they had elections, same thing. The incumbent left-leaning party was expected to lose. Suddenly, they got basically demolished by a resurgent liberal, in this case, left-leaning party in Canada, in which the incumbent prime minister basically ran against Trump and for Australian Canadian sovereignty. Were there any parallels in Australia? And how is Australia politically going to manage this contradiction, it seems, between U.S. being the security partner and China being the trade partner? How are they going to navigate this going forward in the age of Trump?
With great difficulty. And we are enmeshed irrevocably with America as our key security partner. As you gentlemen would know, very strong ties in the defense and intelligence areas, longstanding ties. That will continue. At the same time, we've got China as our key economic partner, and the Labor government has improved economic relations with China over this last term of government, resulting in the Chinese regime dropping various trade boycotts on Australian goods. So The government won't want to unsettle the horses there in terms of China being our key economic trading partner. As to how they manage that dichotomy, it's going to be one of the most challenging areas for the newly re-elected Labor government. On Canada, there are differences between what happened in Australia last night and what we saw happen in Canada. Yes, there was the overarching common factor of Donald Trump being toxic. Any politician tied to Donald Trump, it seems, is going to suffer badly at the hand of voters. We saw that with the Canadian Conservative leader. We saw that to some extent with Peter Dutton last night. We're different, though. In Australia, suffer the existential threat the Canadians are suffering with Donald Trump repeatedly talking about wanting to make Canada the 51st state. He hasn't at this stage threatened to make Australia the 52nd state. Give him time, who knows? So there's that. And of course, Canada was hit much harder by the Liberation Day tariff regime as well. We got off relatively lightly. So there are those two key differences, but the overarching commonality, in my view, was that it is now going to be a successful tactic for any leader, any political party to tie their opponent to Donald Trump. If they succeed in that, that opponent is going to suffer very badly at the hand of voters.
So I was grinning through that because while I was in Canberra, when we would have military delegations come, I would often, during my remarks to them as they got there, remind them that, quote, Australia is not the 51st state. And the reason I would say that was not because anybody wanted to take over Australia, but because U.S. and Australian militaries work so closely together, sometimes our own folks could be surprised that Australia actually had different policies. You know, they just assumed that everything was the same. But in that light, we have a question in the chat about the Pacific, or as we might think of it in the United States, the South Pacific, the Pacific Islands, China's competition in the South Pacific, and specifically Australia's concern over those Pacific Islands, which from an American perspective or even other places might seem disproportionate to their size. What role does China's competition in the Pacific play in Labor's mind, in the Liberals' mind? Do you see any changes going forward?
Oh, I think Labor will continue to engage strongly with the Pacific. I mean, they're very proud of their record in the Pacific. The coalition in the campaign actually, I think, promised to cut aid funding, which I don't think went down very well in the Pacific. Looking north, Papua New Guinea, Australia's promised the government's promised to fund a rugby league team there. But like more seriously though, I think the government strongly believes that climate change is sort of the ticket to entry in diplomacy with the Pacific Islands. But look, Australia's aid is going to continue to be reorientated to the Pacific.
Was there any discussion about the cuts in US aid and what role Australia might play during the election? I don't recall that, but I mean, Australia was once referred to as the deputy sheriff in the region. Well, maybe we become the sheriff. And I expect we'll be doing, a lot more work with our New Zealand friends and our Japanese friends if the US pull back. But Australia's, doing a good job, forging, policing agreements with, various Pacific Island countries, training their police, economic empowerment, technical assistance on issues such as cyber. If America's going to sort of withdraw from that space, we'll be expected to step up.
So no ambassador has yet been named for Australia by Donald Trump. We know what that's like.
Some of us know very personally what's...
You know what that's like, Jim.
Jim Caruso was the acting ambassador for 2.5 years, And when he stepped down finally, and an ambassador was finally named, the foreign minister at the time, Julie Bishop, called him the best ambassador Australia never had.
Because I was a pushover. But I'm seriously, the question is it worse this time not having an ambassador because Donald Trump is more aggressive? Does it make a difference? Would it make a difference having an ambassador now?
Well, firstly, can I echo Julie Bishop's thought? I think, Jim Caruso, you were the best ambassador Australia never had.
Have you on, Michael?
I don't know when we'll get an ambassador from America. There's no prospect of one being named anytime soon in the roiling chaos that we see every single day in Washington. Will an ambassador matter? Perhaps not, given that Donald Trump rules supreme and leaders want to directly deal with him, even though Anthony Albanese has been trying to get a phone call with Donald Trump ever since Liberation Day, and that hasn't happened. Probably will happen now that, as protocol dictates, world leaders will call the newly elected prime minister, so perhaps Donald Trump will be hopefully on the top of that list. But I don't think having an ambassador or not, really, in the age of Donald Trump, will make a huge amount of difference at all, because all the action will be in Washington. Kevin Rudd has been a very effective Australian ambassador over there. He'll be redoubling efforts to get access to the president and various other figures in the West Wing. I really don't think having a person in the palatial US embassy in Canberra will make a difference. Can I say to all those, I'm sure, watching from the US embassy, they all do a fantastic job at keeping the embassy ticking over anyway, as you did, Jim, in your
acting. If you've seen the miniseries Pine Gap, you know that the US ambassador can actually control the movement of ships around Sydney Harbour from his office there. It's pretty exciting.
Yes, of course.
I would like to ask what happens now to the Liberal Party and who leads it?
Yeah, well, there's already manoeuvres in play, and apparently there were manoeuvres in play last week. But I think that the three front runners will be the current deputy leader, Susan Ley, Dan Tehan, who's shadow immigration, and maybe Andrew Hastie, the shadow defence, although it's probably not his time. But yeah, definitely Angus Taylor as well, the shadow treasurer. Although he's copping a bit of internal criticism for not, being as fiscally conservative as some would have liked, and not rolling out policies as early as some would have liked. So there's going to be a lot of undermining and blame shifting, and they've got some soul searching to do. I mean, I can see the appeal of Susan Ley because she's moderate and she might be able to win some of those teal seats back. I think she'll remain part of the leadership group. Just a question of whether she gets the number one spot. But more broadly, the a lot of coalition front benches were wiped out. And not just Dutton, but, folks like Luke Howarth, David Coleman, the shadow foreign minister, he's gone. He's quite well regarded, very cerebral, experienced MP. So, who have they got left? And, it goes to sort of this existential crisis that the Liberals are facing. And, they got smashed, during World War II. Maybe, they called, a conference of, the conservative political parties in Australia and, try some sort of reformation and, just recast their image, because at the moment it's just not working.
It's just, as you say, it's certainly a personnel issue. The current and potential future Liberal Party leadership was decapitated in the election, from Peter Dutton down, a range of well-regarded future Liberal leaders, potential leaders, lost their seats as well. So there's a personnel issue, but also a direction issue. Christopher Pyne, who you all know, and who most people watching this would know as well, former defense minister, now still works in the defense space, was on one of the TV panels last night. He's a moderate, liberal, very much centrist, and he was making that point on air that the Liberal Party, in his view, needs to tap back to the center. It has veered right under the Peter Dutton and, to a lesser extent, Scott Morrison leadership regimes, in his view, and in the view of many Liberal Party moderates, that the party needs to come back to the center because that is where the electorate is, as was shown so dramatically last night.
Just to play devil's advocate, the right-wing parties of One Nation, Pauline Hanson, and Clive Palmer's, what's he call it? The Trumpet Party, which is just...
Trumpet of Patriots.
And I wonder how he came up with that name. They've got, I think, between them, something like 2 million votes. That's pretty substantial. And if you include then coalition voters, the right wing still has something going for it, it seems. Maybe that's what they're going to become. What do you think?
I think if they're smart, they'll they recognize that there is always going to be that right flank, and the preferences that we talked about earlier will always flow to the Liberal and National Party in future elections. But as again was shown last night, that is not, at the moment at least, where the Australian electorate is. Any pathway back to power for the coalition has to go through those so-called teal six, those former blue ribbon, blue chip Liberal Party seats that were lost the election before last, and given the results last night, may be harder than ever for the Liberal Party to win back. But they need to win back those seats to get the numbers to form a government in the lower house, which goes back to what the likes of Christopher Pyne and other party elders have been saying in the wake of the defeat, that they have any prospect of winning. The Liberal Party needs to recognise and support and welcome the support of right-leaning voters, but there are many more voters in the middle, including those key metropolitan seats the Liberal Party needs to get any shot of getting back into power anytime soon.
All right, let's close on this thought. So Labor obviously comes out of this looking very strong. Does Labor have any, or would you think that Labor would have any agenda for what it might do in its new stronger position? Would a more confident Labor start to introduce any policies that are really significant?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. Albanese, during one of the debates in the campaign, was asked, you know, what would he'd want his political legacy to be, and he said universal childcare or something to that effect. So that'll be big in this term of government. I think the net zero transition, that's core to Labor's economic reform agenda, and I think given the flak they copped and yet they prevailed big time in the election, I think Labor's just gonna pursue that. Their ambitious renewable energy target of 82% by 2030. That's a huge undertaking. It's going to cost a lot of money. Chris Bowen has copped a lot of, he's the current energy and climate minister. He's copped a lot of flack for that. They're going to have to roll out about 30,000 kilometres of new grid. There's going to be billions of this so-called off budget spend on that. That's one part of it. A key part of this net zero transition, which is core to their economic agenda, is this initiative called the Future Made in Australia. So that's all about sort of attracting investment into these net zero industries. So things like renewable hydrogen, critical minerals, green metals, low carbon fuels and clean energy manufacturing, batteries and that sort of stuff. So Labor's keen to sort of streamline investment into those sectors. Just on critical minerals, I know we're short of time. I mean, during the campaign, Labor promised to establish a critical minerals stockpile, which I think is very significant. It sort of ties into this Future Made in Australia initiative. And the idea of that is this stockpile to benefit local manufacturers, and also those of our allies as well. So India, Japan, Korea, and the US. And there's talk of this critical mineral stockpile, you know, being used as leverage in the tariff negotiations with Trump. So yeah, watch this space.
All right. Well, that was one of the questions that was in the chat, was on to what extent we might see those critical minerals and rare earths used as leverage in the tariffs, especially given what we just saw in Ukraine. Well, so we do want to thank our guests for coming on today. It's been a fascinating discussion. I think I walked away smarter, which is pretty hard to do for me. So thank you very much. I want to thank my co-host, Jim Caruso, and of course, our sponsor, Bauer Group Asia. Bauer Group applies unmatched expertise and experience to help clients navigate the world's most complex and dynamic markets. And I don't know that Australia is one of the most complex, but I do think that it can be very dynamic. Of course, Mick McNeil is the managing director of Bauer Group Asia in Australia. So finally, we want to thank our producer, Ian Ellis-Jones and IEJ Media, for doing all the work behind the scenes to make all of this happen. Of course, you can follow him on X at Ian Ellis-Jones, and you can follow us on YouTube.com/IP Podcast. We also do the regular audio podcast on all the places, whether it be Apple Podcasts or Spotify or any of those. Finally, if you have any thing you'd like to say to us, or you think this was great, you think it was terrible, you can always let us know. You can send us an email, IndoPacificPodcast@gmail.com. Thank you to all, and thank you for joining us on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?